How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's time to catch up on what's been happening across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap, where we take you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
Three, two, one.
Classes are in session and the fall semester is underway.
Chicago Public Schools students dealing with
sweaty and sticky days of extreme heat in Chicago, even breaking records.
Mayor Johnson has been quietly interviewing candidates to replace current Chicago Public Schools CEO Pedro Martinez.
Chicago city budget could be short nearly $1 billion.
I sat down with Chalk Beach Chicago Bureau Chief Becky Vivi, Mitch Armantrout, government and politics reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Natalie Moore, who joined us on her last day as WBEZ's race, class, and communities editor. Becky started us off by explaining a breakthrough in stalled contract negotiations for Chicago public school teachers.
Well, it sounds like the district is preparing to make an offer of 5% raises annually for teachers over the course of the next several years. Your colleague here at WBEZ, Sarah Karp, broke that story last night. And, you know, I would say, you know, earlier this month we had been looking at, we had gotten a memo where the mayor was pushing the district to consider this short-term borrowing to pay for the cost of the contract. And in that memo, they mentioned 4% raises. Mm-hmm. So this would be, a little bit more than what was in that memo. And we'll see if it actually creates the breakthrough that, you know, the teachers union may be hoping for. I think that over the summer, the district and the teachers union held these open bargaining sessions for the first time, but they're still meeting behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of the real work, I think, is happening.
Yeah.
So yet to be seen where that will land. But yeah, news last night that they're going to make that offer.
Definitely big news. Now, Mitch, we cannot have a conversation about public schools without addressing the ongoing reports that Mayor Brandon Johnson wanted to replace schools CEO Pedro Martinez. What is the latest that you're hearing? Because I know I saw the two of them hanging out on Monday.
Right. They're sort of in this strange sort of political limbo, it feels like, right now. Like you said, our colleagues reported, I believe, last month that Mayor Johnson is kind of working behind the scenes to potentially find a new interim replacement to put at the top of CPS. But on Monday, for the first day of school, you know, they toured a few schools together, ringing bells and welcoming parents. And, you know, by all accounts, seeming very friendly with each other.
Yeah.
They seem to have put aside, to put aside any differences that might be going on behind the scenes, at least for, you know, that sort of a feel good first day of school. I think for Pedro Martinez, you know, I think he sort of has a sigh of relief entering the first day of school, just because, you know, if Mayor Johnson is trying to make a change at the top happen, that's a lot easier to happen before school starts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, things just get a lot more complicated the longer this draws out.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you hearing about this, Becky?
Well, it's worth noting that yesterday at the board meeting, a letter was made public by it was signed by about 400 principals and assistant principals asking the board to keep Pedro Martinez at the top for the sake of stability, for the sake of having consistency at the top, you know, to keep the momentum going, if you will, and to keep this school year humming along.
Yeah.
As somebody who, you know, covered lots of turnover in CEOs past, you know, Janice Jackson was in place for about 5 years. Pedro Martinez has been in this role for three, has a couple more years on his contract. And so I think there is this question of, like, do you let him stay through the end of his contract, which was sort of what, when Mayor Johnson took office last year,
yeah,
people thought, oh, he's making the decision to keep him in place and have him stay through his contract. They must be aligned on most things. And so it is interesting. I think unless the mayor were to sort of force a resignation. Mm-hmm. Everything we heard was that the board has no intention of taking the vote to replace him. And he has no intention of like personally stepping down. So it'll be interesting to see. And I do know, I do think that some of this has to do with some of the pressure around negotiations as well, because, you know, Johnson is a friend of the teachers union and he talked on the campaign trail about delivering bad news to his friends. But I think, you know, that those negotiations are still working themselves out. And I think CPS and Pedro Martinez have to sort of get, you know, in alignment with the mayor at times on some of, you know, they're together. Those two are management side. He's, you know, it's like he's in this really weird position.
Very interesting. Well, you know, Natalie, Pedro Martinez says that he has not met privately with Brandon Johnson in weeks. And he says that he's not sure when they'll be meeting again. Are you surprised by that at all?
I guess not. I don't really know what to expect out of this because Martinez doesn't, he hasn't resigned. I don't think that it would be a good look to Chicagoans, to the public, to the CPS community if Martinez is let go while negotiations is are happening.
Once the school year has already begun.
I think it would be, it's like, well, why are you waiting so long? And because you're not getting your way, you're trying to dump someone. So I don't think it's going to go anywhere because I think politically it would be damaging.
Well, Mitch, late Wednesday, Mayor Johnson painted a bleak financial picture for the city. He says it faces a nearly $1 billion budget gap in 2025. So how does this impact what we're talking about? What's at the heart of this disagreement between the mayor and the CPS CEO, which is the school district's budget crisis and that teacher contract?
Well, one of the biggest budget obstacles that the city is facing is this pension payment that is due to non-teaching positions in the CPS. I believe it's a $175 million payment that for the last several years the district has covered. Pedro Martinez and the Board of Education passed a budget, I believe, last month, which sort of puts that burden back on the city, which adds to just a pretty bleak financial picture across the board for the city. This is sort of a financial cliff that folks have seen for a few years coming. As COVID-19 relief funds from the federal government dry up, so now the city's, at least this early forecast from Johnson's office says that they're expecting to be short about $982 million, so almost $1 billion.
That's a lot of money.
So that's, you know, obviously every budget season, mayors are talking about cuts and, you know, places where they can tighten, but this seems like it's going to be an outlier.
Yeah, to your point, Mayor Johnson said sacrifices will have to be made, but he's kind of stopped short of giving a definitive solution. Let's listen.
There are a litany or plethora amount of options that are on the table that my administration will be exploring collectively.
So did we hear anything about options that, you know, would be needed to deal with this budget gap, like a property tax hike maybe?
Nothing specific, just sort of general ideas of one, a hiring freeze, two, you know, cutting services where you can, and, you know, three, obviously the elephant in the room is a potential property tax increase, which is an especially radioactive political sort of pitfall for the mayor because he campaigned on a promise not to raise property taxes.
That's right.
Which he didn't do in his first budget. So if he's forced to do that in his second budget, that's obviously not something he wants to do as he tries to maintain favorability among voters. So this is sort of, you know, budget season lasts up until next spring. So, I mean, we've got... This is sort of like him sort of laying out the bad news, kind of trying to gauge the reaction, trying to get ideas from folks.
How did city council react?
You know, the folks who you would expect to really jump sort of on Brandon about this, his critics in the council have, you know, come out pretty hard and saying, you know, this is something that we should have seen come and should have been prepared for. But again, you know, there's still a while yet to see exactly the ideas that come forward to bridge that gap.
Right. Well, Becky... thinking of that huge shortfall. I mean, your thoughts on how that might impact CPS and its budget and the ongoing negotiations with the teachers union?
Well, you know, CPS, similar to the city, has faced a big deficit, in part because federal COVID money that was, you know, showered upon all of local governments has dried up and is drying up. You know, for the school district, that was the core reason why CPS was facing such a large deficit was, okay, suddenly we don't have this one-time money, and how are we going to maintain what we've been used to the last few years, similar to the city? I think there is this interesting, like Mitch mentioned, the pension payment, which is actually a portion of the pension payment that Lori Lightfoot, as mayor, shifted to the schools, saying, hey, listen, like, you're most of the people covered under this fund are non-teaching staff, are CPS or former CPS employees. Therefore, CPS should take on a portion of this payment. Teachers union, including Brandon Johnson, were very opposed to that at the time. Now that he's in the mayor's office, it's a little change of tune.
Yikes.
I think that the other thing to note is that while the city goes through its process, CPS will likely have to amend its budget once the district determines what the cost of the contract will be. So 5% raises across the board for teachers and, CTU staff. I think that is going to require a whole series of amendments for the CPS side. So where that pension payment lands could also continue to get batted back and forth while CPS does its amendments. Mm.
Well, I want to take a look now at how the first week actually went. So while CPS was dealing with the busing challenges and the negotiating of a new contract, there was also another very sticky situation, Becky, those record-breaking temperatures.
Yeah, it's hot.
Tuesday's heat index reached 114 degrees. How did the schools handle the heat?
You know, they going into the week, you know, as parent, you know, that you got on Sunday, they sent letters to everybody saying we have air conditioners in classrooms, at the very least. But most CPS buildings are old and don't have air conditioning. They have window units in classrooms, essentially.
I hear the complaints from my teens all the time.
The hallways are hot. The other areas of the building are hot.
I kind of got them excited. Hot. I shared that Sunday email with them. I was like, oh, look, I think your air conditioners are fixed.
Like, well, you know, anybody who's had a window unit knows that it's like not going to heat or cool your whole
house. They came back on Monday like, no, mommy.
It's still hot.
It's still hot.
So not only was it, you know, you could only do so much with window units. I think there was, you know, there certainly were window units that didn't, you know, that broke down, didn't stick, you know, that weren't functioning. CPS did say that they had facilities people out in the field, you know, rapidly trying to respond and get those units fixed. They had a whole bunch of on hand, essentially new ones that they could replace any that were not functioning. The relief of Thursday when it got a little cooler, I think helped. And I know, like at my own kids' school, they have window units. And I think they were able to stay pretty cool for the most part, but they did keep kids inside for recess on that first two days.
I bet they did. And tell me while you're still in the hot seat, Becky, about the bus driver shortage, because that's a thing too. Yeah.
So this is something that has been a challenge for CPS since the pandemic started, since 2020. You know, they continue to cite a driver shortage, which is real and is a challenge. There are fewer drivers than there used to be. However, there are more this year that they were able to hire. But we still had almost 2,000 students with disabilities without rides this week. And no information about when they might get a route or a ride set up for them. So that's huge because these are, you know, students who are among the most disadvantaged in the school system. And to just basically be like, get yourself to school. Like, it's just very challenging when attendance we know is so important for students. I mean, if you can't get to school, you can't be learning. So that's a big thing. They did say that they are busing more students than they were last year at the start of the school year, and that they've continued to make progress on getting more kids on routes. Pedro Martinez also did say on the first day that his goal is to return service by the end of the semester to students who attend magnet and selective enrollment schools who had their busing cut last year because the district was so focused on trying to make sure that students with disabilities had routes that were not more than an hour. This year, they are hoping to restore some of that service to the magnet students through this hub system model that they've kind of done in the past, which is essentially like, get your kid to this spot, you know, maybe it's a local neighborhood school, get on the bus there, and then we'll take those kids to their magnet schools. So we'll see. That's still, we're watching that. Yeah. And my understanding, even with the students with disabilities, is it's kind of a rolling process. So like a family can make a request for transportation, and then it takes some time for them to be assigned a route.
So we'll be talking about this bus driver shortage for a while.
Yeah, I feel like we have been for several
have been.
Years.
And since I
don't
got
see
here.
It stopping. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't see it ending. It really does puzzle me in some ways, because I feel a little like, are we just like going away from the yellow bus being a reliable thing?
Yeah, that's exactly what's
And it seems like that's
happening.
Where we're at.
And we're not done with you yet, Becky.
Oh boy.
Because
okay.
This was a big week in schools, and you're our education reporter on the panel. So we got news that the CPS Inspector General quietly stepped down. I got to get the tea from you.
I wish I had more tea. I don't know that there's any more tea other than that he took another job. Yeah, he took another job out east. And
at least he didn't say that he was leaving to spend time with his family.
Yes, right. So he stepped
down. So he didn't call you first?
No. We actually, our senior reporter, Mila Kumpilova, caught this on the agenda for the board meeting when it was posted earlier this week. It said that the board would be taking a vote on the interim, naming the interim, if you will. And she was like, looks like maybe the inspector general left. Later that day, WTTW had a story up, and we did finally get confirmation from the school system, as well as the inspector general himself finally called, you know, he called Mila back. And he's taking a new job. Mm-hmm. And the person who is the deputy in charge of the sexual assault unit. Mm-hmm. So within the CPS Inspector General office, about 5 years ago, they created this unit that investigates sexual assault complaints. This was in response to a big investigation the Tribune did, finding a lot of really horrible cases of sexual assault, sexual abuse of kids in schools. And so that the person who leads that unit is now going to step in as the interim. And it's not clear to me if they're going to be running like a search for a new person, or how they'll make someone permanent. But
yeah, Will Fletcher served as the inspector general since 2020. So mm-hmm. Yeah, end of an era. All right. So sticking with schools here, Chicago now has some 9,000 migrant students enrolled. So while this can mean more tax money for CPS, it also presents unique challenges in terms of what resources kids need. So I want to start, and I want to hear from all three of you here, but Becky, on language needs, I'm curious, are there enough bilingual staff to handle the influx of migrant students?
No.
That is the short answer.
I think it's fair to say that as the short answer. And some of that is because this is an area that even before migrants began arriving, there's sort of teacher shortages. You know, you have to get an extra credential, a couple of extra credentials, depending on what type of bilingual education you're going to be teaching. You can get a credential to teach English as a second language. And then there are like actual bilingual certifications. You can teach other subjects in native languages. And there are requirements at the state that once a school enrolls 20 kids, 20 or more who speak the same native language, they have to create what's called a transitional bilingual education program. We knew last spring, Rima Amin and Mina Bloom at Block Club did a joint investigation and story where they did a ton of reporting and looked at a lot of data and essentially identified that there were dozens of schools that were meeting that threshold but did not have these transitional bilingual education programs. And district officials were, you know, frank in answering that, like, listen, there's not a pipeline. We were getting kids in the middle of the year. Like, you can't just prop up a program and hire teachers instantly. And the other interesting layer I found with this story was that, and folks here who have been covering the migrant crisis better than I have know that, you know, a lot of people, as they moved out of shelters, were resettled in neighborhoods on the south and west side, often through the state resettlement program with Catholic Charities. So they were moving to neighborhoods that were really predominantly Black neighborhoods. And those schools, they sometimes didn't even have like a single person who spoke Spanish, much less a bilingual certified teacher. So their challenges were like, okay, do we attend the school now closest to our new apartment? Do we take the bus 2 hours back to the one near our shelter that has bilingual teachers? And so you really had this difficult net of challenges for those families. And I think even for the district to figure out how to respond.
Right.
You know, they were definitely caught on their heels.
Well, I want to hear from you, Natalie, and you, Mitch. I mean, you're not education reporters, but the idea of sort of some of the things that Becky's talking about here. And so those challenges at school, but also like preparing these new arrivals for winter in Chicago and meeting their basic food needs and housing needs. It all makes it seem like a political story, too, doesn't it?
Yes, I'm going to choose to have more of an optimistic lens. The migrants have already been here for winter. So some of these challenges have been ongoing. They're not going to be new. I think that there's also opportunity that is here because when you have migrants settling into neighborhoods that have had population loss, and even though there's a moratorium on school closings, I think that these new children are going to actually help save some of these schools from potentially closing later. So I think, you know, one thing that we are, you know, have been looking at the team is does the future look like? What is acculturation, assimilation, becoming neighbors in these communities, and schools is a place. So I think that the city of Chicago is being reshaped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It for sure the long term. It's not just in this moment. It's not just the start of school or the winter that's coming. And we've seen waves of immigration in this city, and we've seen absorption of Ukrainians, and there wasn't this, like, what's, you know, it wasn't as political.
Yeah.
Different circumstances because they weren't, but they were still here for other political reasons, even if they weren't on a bus from Texas. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's something to see over the short, medium, and long term about the makeup of our schools and the makeup of our communities and how it can be seen as a positive.
Yeah.
To add to what Natalie was saying, I think this year one of the things we're looking at is how many of those schools have gotten bilingual resources and almost, you know, to see sort of, I think South Shore is a place where you see, you know, if the district has set, and I will say, like, even as these kids were landing, you know, teachers were doing, you know, heroic work.
Right.
School staff in these places were doing incredible work just trying to figure out how to serve some of these students. And I do think you did see, and maybe do see at the start of this year, some optimism that, okay, let's use this to our advantage. You know, let's get a Spanish program because our school hasn't had one. And that would be great for our kids who've been enrolled here too. So
yeah.
I think some people are trying to see it as like an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And these problems are not, I mean, my daughter's school is supposed to offer Spanish.
Oh, it doesn't?
Principal can't find a Spanish teacher.
Yeah.
Oh. And this isn't even bilingual, ESL. It is so hard to find a teacher, and she has been trying for close to 3 years.
Wow. Well, another issue, this has us jumping over to Indiana for a moment, but schools there made headlines. They're joining other states in banning cell phone use in schools. I'm curious, Mitch, do you think that rampant cell phone use has become a problem in school?
Just based on...
what does your spidey sense tell you?
Just based on the way my niece uses electronics and my friends' kids are on their phone all the time. And I've got friends who are teachers who say that, yeah, that's one of their biggest issues is trying to get kids to put down their phones, pay attention in class, and, you know, things as simple as reading out loud. Like, it's tough to sort of keep the focus going. I mean, obviously, it's always hard to keep kids focused on anything, but even more so when you've got... they've got the world at their fingertips with the cell phone. So, I think it'll be interesting to see more school districts potentially adopt this. I know some suburbs in Illinois are instituting no electronics policies.
They're in conversation, for sure. I admitted recently on the program that I am the parent that I think contributes to the problem by texting.
Oh, you're that parent who's texting during the principals don't like
ma'am.
That.
Sasha. I know you have thoughts on this, Natalie. Yes. Go ahead.
Well, I think the problem is not just the students having these devices. Schools are saying, hey, parents, please don't reach out to your kid during
school anymore.
Hours.
I've learned. I'm a better person.
I think this is harder to probably regulate in high school, but in elementary school, I would say ban them.
In elementary school, absolutely.
I think there's no, like, how do you get in touch? you call the school.
Yeah,
the school.
How we
you
used
call
to get in
773-535, whatever those yeah. four.
Yes,
four
the landline, my friends. It's called a landline.
I think the other thing that's at play here, you know, we can talk about kids' addictions to the screens, but it's also a type of surveillance that parents are doing. Mm-hmm. Parents are worried that there could be a mass shooting. Well, if there is, the school, like, you can't do anything. I'm not trying to minimize these concerns, but also, you know, 360 LifeLock. I mean, I'm personally making the choice of no phone at this age. I don't want to surveil our children, mm-hmm. and I don't want them to know where I am. I don't want them asking me, hey, I see you're here. Can you go
right.
get me something? Yeah.
Pick something up. And so I think the culture that we have of instant communication, instant access is probably doing more harm. And I know the arguments, but what if, but. And, you know, when you know better, you do better. And I don't mean to sound like get off my lawn, but we were able to survive without this. You call the school clerk, and if they're, and the school nurse will call you if your kid is sick. There are things that are in place.
We survived without these things before, and we could probably keep going. Now, demolition of the Chicago Tribune's former printing plant began Tuesday. In its place will be the city's first permanent casino. Mitch, you were there for all the red and white smoke.
Right, and all the heat. It was that day where it was like 105.
Oh, it was hot.
Sweating through their clothes. It was a party atmosphere by all accounts. At least for the Bally's executives who were there, they had flew in folks from across the country. You know, it's a national company, and you know, they started blaring "We Will Rock You." They're blowing off smoke bombs. Mm-hmm. It was a whole spectacle of them sort of a ceremonial kicking off of demolition of the Chicago Tribune plants over there at Chicago Avenue in Halsted. You know, this is a project that's been years in the making, almost 5 years since Chicago first got a casino license. You know, there's been beset by delays basically at every step of the process at all levels. So I think everyone from the, at least in Mayor Brandon Johnson's office and at Bally's, they're just sort of excited to sort of get this show on the road. You know, this is, again, we talked about the city's budget issues earlier. The casino is supposed to be generating eventually up to $200 million a year for pension funds that are desperately underfunded. It's for now, everyone's sort of feeling optimistic about the process, and we'll see how those numbers do end up turning out.
So, Natalie, a representative from the city's tourism agency, told the crowd on Tuesday that it, quote, wasn't a demolition day, it was a celebration day, right? Just as Mitch said, let's listen to what some of that sounded like.
3, 2, 1, smash!
There it is. Do you think it felt like a celebration for journalists, Natalie, especially our colleagues at the Tribune? I mean, that was their building.
I mean, they were a little weepy about it. It's the end of an era. The newsroom had not been there that long, but the plant had been there. So, no, it wasn't a celebration for for them.
What do you think about this Freedom Center turning into a casino?
I mean, I don't know. I think it's...
Will you go?
I don't think so, no. I do know I covered all of the spats and fights over the traffic and, there's so much traffic. And
Yeah, you were on reset.
I have kind of started to just, you know, block that out of my brain. But, you know, if it's going to solve our budget woes and get the mayor's office and CPS to stop fighting over pension payments, maybe that'll help, you know, make my life a little easier.
27th Ward Alderman Walter Burnett, who grew up three blocks from the casino site in what was then the Cabrini Green housing project. He participated in the festivities, but he issued a warning as well.
If my folks don't eat, nobody eat. So if Cabrini Green people don't get to work on this site, there will be no more development in the 27th Ward until I'm satisfied.
So Bally's has made a lot of promises, Mitch, to the city about hiring Chicagoans. Do you think that Alderman Burnett would actually block the development if his residents in his ward don't benefit?
I think he certainly talks a big game, and we'll see how that goes. Talking to him after that press conference, you know, he doesn't actually have like a sort of a scientific set of metrics about what that would look like. As far as Bally's commitment to the city, they say that they're going to create about 3,000 permanent jobs, and about a quarter of those would be, their target for local folks from the South and West sides. For Walter Burnett to say that he would, you know, hold up other developments in his ward,
yeah,
that's a big deal, because the 27th ward, that's includes Fulton Market, sort of that near west side around the United Center, basically where you've seen a lot of major development in the city over the last decade. He's vice mayor. He's certainly a very influential voice in city council. And I think Bally's and other companies should certainly heed his warning.
Yeah. Well, Natalie, it was notable that the actual mayor, Brandon Johnson, was not there on Tuesday. What do you think about that?
You know, when the mayor doesn't show up, there are multiple places that he doesn't show up, and it leaves us speculating about...
I mean, Walter Burnett is his vice mayor, but like the mayor wasn't there.
I would love to hear what Mitch probably knows better than me, but I will say that the mayor was exhibiting some... he was dubious about whether this was going to happen, mm-hmm. and then Bally's pulled it off. And we are in a different place where there is groundbreaking. I mean, I can't imagine that they just did not invite him. But
no, I mean, I'm sure he was invited. I mean, he did leave a statement, right?
Right, yeah. Mitch? So the mayor sort of issued a written statement calling this, you know, one of the biggest investments in Chicago. But again, not like overly flowery rhetoric for what could potentially, you know, be make or break thing for city pensions down the line. It's certainly a photo op you would expect to see the mayor at. And we didn't really get a clear answer on what Mayor Johnson was up to.
Yeah, like where was he instead?
As far as his public schedule for that day, he didn't have anything else on the agenda. That doesn't mean that he didn't have other business.
Sure.
On his,
but I mean, this was very much a feather in the cap of Lori Lightfoot, his predecessor. And, you know, she really kind of brought this home mm-hmm. after the legislation in Springfield was passed. And, you know, previous mayors had not been able to do this. And so I think this is also something that I think, you know, when administrations change over sometimes, you know, because of unexpected twists of events, I'm sure, I'm kind of curious, where was Lori Lightfoot? You know, right. I'm sure she would have been.
He inherited this.
Like to have mm-hmm. been there. And but these projects take so long. They do often outlast, and often the train has left the station before, you know, it was well on its way before he took office. So
yeah, and there are certainly critics who are still questioning whether Bally's can actually finish this almost $2 billion project. They've mm-hmm. never built, this is a company that hasn't built anything like this from the ground up. So Brandon Johnson is still sort of at a position in his term where he can sort of keep this project at arm's length. He can inherit sort of the successes that could come from it, but he can also sort of distance himself from any potential catastrophe.
And there are also questions about whether it's going to give that tax benefit, like how much of the tax benefit will happen to keep the city and CPS from fighting over those pensions.
Or is it going to be like what we hear, you know, when people are like, oh, what about that lottery money? We're supposed to get lottery money for the schools. And it's
This permanent casino is scheduled to be up and running in the fall of 2026. Mitch, would you bet on that?
You've been saving that, Sasha.
That is all our producer, Andrea Guffman.
This is a massive project. It's a 500-room hotel. It's a casino. It's a parking garage and a theater. It's a lot of work to pack into essentially 3 years or less, or I should say less than 2 years, because demolition is expected to last through the rest of this year. So it feels like it's a long shot.
The odds are feeling kind of slim.
Oh, you are on fire.
Sorry. All right. Get me out of here. All right. Moving on. In state election news, an Illinois Supreme Court ruling could impact the November ballot. Now, Mitch, this has to do with a law that Democrats quickly pushed through, and it was banning what's called candidate slating. Get us up to speed on that.
So in Illinois, a lot of times, we've got a primary election system. So, you know, candidates run to be the Democratic candidate, the Republican candidate, and a few other smaller third parties. But that's an expensive process to run candidates in, you know, more than 100 state house races. You've got state senate races, all kinds of races. So what a lot of times parties will do, specifically the Republican Party, which is, you know, in a deep minority in Illinois, they won't bother running a candidate in the primary. Instead, they'll have a local party committees will slate the candidate for a specific race just for the general election. This is the way it's been for as long as I know. Democrats passed this law that essentially blocked that process from happening, from saying basically you have to run a primary election to have anyone appear on the general election ballot. They passed this after the primary election, which obviously outraged Republicans who are depending on this process to run candidates in November.
Yeah.
And it was actually kind of a surprising decision from the Illinois Supreme Court, just because it's a Democratic majority court, essentially siding against, you know, Governor J.B. Pritzker and state house leaders who have defended this as a constitutional situation. But for at least this year, this election year, state party committees can slate their candidates, but this law is still going to be on the books. So in theory, unless barring another court challenge, that will not be the case in 2026.
WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future.
All right. Well, in other state news, more people are traveling to Illinois than any other state for abortion access. Apparently, the need is so great that the nonprofit Chicago Abortion Fund is running out of money. Natalie, just fill us in briefly on the challenges that the group is facing. And I know that this topic is something that you just recently wrote about as well for the Sun-Times.
Yeah, so our colleague at WBEZ, Kristen Shores, did a story about the money drying up. In 2019, the Chicago Abortion Fund does is pay for travel and abortion for people who can't afford it. You call a hotline. And in 2019, I did a story on them about, because at that point, before Roe was overturned, you had so many out-of-state people coming for abortions. So in 2019, they were spending $160,000. Since 2022, they have spent $8
million.
Wow. Yeah. And the donations have been coming in because a lot of people, when Roe fell, said, what can I do? And people said, we need money. And Chicago is, you know, one of the best known abortion funds because of Illinois and the protections that are here. Mm-hmm. But now they are going to have to limit who comes here based on that money. So,
and we've had the Chicago Abortion Fund on this program many times. Like that's not something they've had to do in a long time.
Right.
So this must be a very challenging time for them.
So they're limiting to states around the Midwest, and then the farthest state is Arkansas, and that's because of some partnerships that they have.
Yeah.
So they have, you know, ramped up, scaled up, but they're worried about the money drying up.
And this topic, as well as what fertility issues and issues of motherhood, all of this was center stage at the DNC, right?
Yeah, so I wrote a piece about, it was crystallizing to me that motherhood was a thing, the right to be a mother, the right not to be a mother, the way you want to parent, violent free from gun violence, and also IVF, all of these things are tied together. And what I noticed, and yes, we're still talking about the DNC, but reproductive issues are a cornerstone of Kamala Harris's campaign. Mm-hmm. In addition to the motherhood thing, what I have noticed is that Democrats have changed how they talk about abortion.
Yeah.
President Joe Biden is for reproductive rights, but he's not comfortable with the word abortion. And I notice that the word pro-choice is not being used because choice makes it sound like you have access. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk to the Chicago Abortion Fund, for example, it's like, yes, these rights are here in some of these states and not in some, but who has access? And if you have to go to another state to get an abortion, you have to take off work. You're missing money. You might have childcare. If you live in Mississippi, the closest place is Chicago and or Illinois, I should say. And hearing the word abortion talked about freely at the DNC and continue to be talked about is a big change. And as someone who's a child of the 90s, Bill Clinton used to say, keep abortion safe, legal, and rare. That was the mantra that I grew up hearing. And people have now recognized the stigma that said that there's shame.
Yeah.
Like, why does it have to be? Like, it's a medical procedure.
Yeah. So and we seem to be back to those times where it's free to talk about it.
Right. And the Chicago Abortion Fund, to, you know, loop it back in 2019, part of the work that I was doing was how they were changing the language. And some of the language has been, everyone loves someone who had an abortion. You might not know because that shame, but the stats for how many women have abortions means that it's, you very
it's
likely.
It's closer to you than you than you might think. All right, attorneys for the once powerful Democrat, now disgraced former House Speaker Mike Madigan were in court this week. This was ahead of his October corruption trial, Mitch. What is the very latest?
It's sort of the trial that just can't quite
because
seem
it's not
to start.
October yet. Yeah, so why are we talking about this? Is what I really wanted to say.
Madigan's lawyers are basically trying to prevent prosecutors from introducing a litany of different evidence. Chiefly, one of their expert witnesses that they want to bring to the stand, who's a former alderman Dick Simpson. He's written books about corruption and patronage across Chicago and Illinois. And basically prosecutors sort of want him to tell jurors how sort of the Chicago machine works, the system that's sort of as old as time in Chicago of doling out jobs for political favors and political basically muscle to help get it out the vote for certain candidates. Madigan's team says that would essentially, you know, automatically paint Mr. Madigan as just sort of part of that machine, which they don't think is fair. They're also trying to prevent prosecutors from talking about different reports that have come out over the years as far as his assistance to help associates land positions at Metra. They want to bar basically discussion of how gambling legislation has come together in Springfield, because they say that that would, again, predispose jurors to connecting him to, you know, thinking of, when they think of Madigan, they think of vice and sort of, you know, cronyism, these sorts of things. So it's worth noting that Alderman Simpson was originally supposed to be called as a witness earlier this year in the Comet 4 case, which was loosely related to Madigan and his influence in Springfield. And a judge ruled that, that Simpson would potentially bias some jurors. So
I see.
To make a choice in Madigan's case, but yes, the clock is ticking towards that October
trial day. It is sure ticking. All right, so I guess we can file this next story under be careful what you wish for, because a lot of us, we want to see women's basketball succeed, right? But the ticket prices are now sky high for this evening's Chicago Sky versus Indiana Fever game. What is the latest, Natalie?
I think that some tickets are going for close to $2,500.
Ooh,
so
that's a lot.
People want to see the showdown between Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark of the Fever. So, you know, I went to a game on Sunday.
Yeah.
$35 tickets. Deeply discounted because my daughter's dance school was performing at halftime. And, the Sky games are just such a different vibe from the Bulls. It's a more intimate arena, way more kids, way more women.
Yeah.
And there's really no bad. I mean, our seats were pretty fantastic, but they don't seem to really be bad seats. Like, you can really see Angel Reese. And so today, my daughter is wearing her Angel Reese.
Oh, how cute.
Shirt with her new Jordans. She's got her little Friday fit together. but it is exciting. I hope that tickets just don't remain out of reach for regular people. Like, the, you know, when the Bulls were hot, it was the same thing.
Well, two young ladies from the Roseland neighborhood, they wouldn't let these high costs of the tickets stand in their way to attending tonight's game. What did they do, Natalie?
This is my story of the week. These sisters, 11 and 12, in Roseland, wanted to go to a Sky game. Mm-hmm. Their mother, in the spirit of mother saying, do you have McDonald's money? Do you have Stanley Cup money? Said,
do you have tickets? Chicago Sky money?
Yeah. Because she saw they were $200 each. And so for a family to go, that's, you know, that's not accessible.
Right.
And so just like children have done for decades, when they want to earn money, they set up a lemonade stand.
Aww, so
cute. I love this story because it's also, so many people have a negative view of Roseland about gun violence. And so here's a story of, you know, moxie from these two sisters. And it got attention. A nonprofit donated $2,000 for them to get tickets. They're going to ride in the limo. And the Sky is going to give them VIP treatment. So I would bet they're going to get a photo op with Angel Reese.
So they didn't have to raise the full $2,000.
So because you can't
lemonade, you'd have to sell a lot of money.
You'd have to pay a lot of money. If you get $50 selling lemonade.
I was wondering. I was waiting for the end of that story.
You can get some chicken nuggets for at the arena for what you can raise.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, y'all. Time's winding down. Labor Day weekend is upon us. Any big plans around the room?
On Sunday, very much looking forward to Bike the Drive. You'll see me out there.
Oh, is that this weekend?
It is Sunday before Labor Day.
How did I miss that?
That's always a great... I did it for the first time last year and really recommend that to anyone and everyone.
Bike the Drive. I love it. I have zero plans. I'm failing this
we
Labor
do have
Day
plans.
Weekend. Well, Promontory Point tomorrow. Yeah, but what else you got going on, Becky?
We're going to see my sister-in-law's family on Monday.
Okay.
A little celebration.
Is she an out-of-towner?
They live Cary, Illinois. It's kind of far suburbs.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a hike, but get the cousins together. It's always a fun weekend to spend some time with them.
Well, for some, the weekend is going to involve travel. So for the first time in 20 years, flight attendants at United Airlines, they voted to authorize a strike. I want to be clear, that doesn't mean that they're going on strike. The vote is a procedural step, and while it does mean the chances of a strike have increased, no one is walking off the job anytime soon. We're just going to definitely keep our eyes on United Airlines right now. All right, our thanks to Becky Vivi of Chalk Beach Chicago, Mitch Armantrout of the Chicago Sun-Times, and WBEZ's Natalie Moore. I want to say a quick word of thanks to you, Natalie. Now, on your last day at WBEZ, after 17 years with the station, don't cry. Oh, you're going to make me cry. You're going to make me cry. Oh, boy. You have worn so many hats, from reporting on race to filling in as guest host on Reset to your current role as editor, writing columns for the Sun-Times. You're that all-around brain that we love to pick. I'm going to make you cry even more because I'm going to read you an email that we just got. This is J.P. Paulus, one of our listeners. He says, I think on behalf of longtime and even lifelong residents of the South Side, we all greatly appreciate her coverage of the area. She's able to give insight that most other reporters simply cannot provide. She's given people like me who have grown up in the suburbs insight that it will be up to us to run with and see the whole city in a better light, not just the popular places. She'll be missed, but we know that she'll be doing great things. So best of luck in your new, exciting role at Northwestern University, Natalie. We love you.
Thank you.
I want to give a special thank you to Reset's production fellow for the past year, Max Lubers. Max's last day with us is today as well, so we are grateful for him producing some very memorable conversations on the show on topics including Illinois' indigenous population and Chicago's migrant crisis. We wish you the best of luck as well, Max.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Max Lubers. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news that you need to know in under an hour. But if you want a few updates throughout the week, sign up for our newsletter. And you can subscribe at WBEZ.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a good weekend and thanks for listening.
I I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.